From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, some say the governor's economic development programs go beyond corruption and the structure is flawed. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on speculation that New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand will run for president in 2020 and will report on a new threat to livestock in Westchester County. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Your Governor Andrew Cuomo's economic development programs have been the subject of two federal corruption trials that ended with convictions for two of Cuomo's former associates. Some say problems with the state's $9 billion economic development programs go beyond corruption and that the structure of the programs is flawed. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt explains.
Cuomo's former closest aide, Joe Percoco, in March was convicted of bribery. On July 12th, Elaine Calieros, the former president of SUNY Polytechnic Institute and the former architect of the governor's biggest economic development deals, including the Buffalo Billion, was found guilty of bid rigging. But groups on the left and the right of the political spectrum say the problem with the state's economic development deals go beyond the corruption cases.
It's almost incidental. It's a predictable result of a bad policy.
E.J. McMahon, with the fiscally conservative budget watchdog group the Empire Center, says the state has built, equipped, and owned $1 billion worth of facilities, including the Solar City factory in Buffalo and a film industry hub near Syracuse during Cuomo's tenure. Solar City employs around 20% of the 3,000 employees initially projected. And the film center, which stood empty for years, was sold to Onondaga County for a dollar. But McMahon says even if they were successful, it's the wrong business for the state to be in.
This is, in classic terms, almost Marxist. This is the state owning the means of production. It's corporate welfare on steroids. This is a business we do not belong in.
McMahon says manufacturers already get tax breaks that are built into state law. He says the state's resources are better spent on infrastructure, and New York should leave more speculative ventures to the corporations. Greg Barilla is with the New York chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. He says the state has resorted to building factories and offering programs like Startup New York, which offers 10 years of tax subsidies to new companies because the state's business climate is so poor.
We have myriad taxes and regulations that a lot of states that our members, again, have to compete with employers in other states, don't have to contend with. And we spend all of this money in New York State, $9 billion in economic development, essentially because it's so hard to attract employers organically.
Barilla says if taxes and regulations were significantly cut, businesses would have a better chance of growing. Ron Deutsch with the union-funded Fiscal Policy Institute agrees that the state should not be in the business of building factories for private businesses. He says if the deals can't be stopped, then the governor and legislature should at least make them more transparent. He says they could create a public database that reveals which companies receive funding and the true costs of the projects.
These mega deals that are happening all around the state, where we're doing everything from, you know, buying buildings for private companies, you know, the contracts and the negotiations and whatnot, are shrouded in secrecy when you compare it to something like a nonprofit contract.
He says not-for-profits have to show far more documentation in exchange for state funding than did the business deals that led to the corruption convictions. The state Senate passed some transparency measures before the legislative session ended in June, but they stalled in the Assembly. Despite the corruption convictions, Governor Cuomo continues to promote his economic development programs. Earlier this month, he announced $10 million in downtown revitalization grants for the Mohawk Valley city of Rome.
The tide is now going with us. This state today, 8 million private sector jobs. More jobs than have ever existed in the history of the state of New York.
And Cuomo continues to tout economic successes in Buffalo, saying the city has turned around. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, as we just heard from our Karen DeWitt, and something, quite frankly, you and I have talked about over and over and over again, Governor Cuomo's economic development programs have been the subject of two federal corruption trials that ended with convictions for two former Cuomo associates. Some critics are saying the problems with the state's $9 billion economic development programs go beyond corruption and that the structure of the programs is flawed. You've always been talking about the pre-audit function.
Yeah, first of all, they took the pre-audit function away from the comptroller, who was the one guy who could have potentially, we don't know if he could have, but his job is to pre-audit a lot of these contracts, meaning do they make sense? Are they corrupt? They took it away. I don't mind that the governor did it. It's his people. It's his program. Of course, I do mind, and I'm just being that way. But it's expected of the governor. By the way, whose numbers in the polls have not budged. He's extremely popular. The people around him are getting convicted. They're falling like flies. Nevertheless, the political outcome for the governor is very unclear. You know, people don't take things seriously until Labor Day, until the ads come out. But right now, it looks like he's home free and that the people are not holding this against him. Now, if you take a look at the structure of the program, it's pay to play all the way. You want a contract, you give a donation. The Supreme Court has said, yeah, but you got to catch the guy on the microphone saying, if you do this, I'll do that. That's called quid pro quo. In this case, Cuomo has not been touched, but the people around him are, and a lot of people think that he should be held responsible politically for letting the mice play while he was sitting on top of this whole thing.
Unions in the Janus case from the Supreme Court, Alan, the state's public worker unions are calling foul over a new group that is formed that basically they say is helping public workers break ties with their union by telling them what's happened in the case.
That's right. I saw that. And it's to be expected. After all, what do you think the Janus case was all about? It was about killing unions. This is something that the present crowd that is in charge of our politics is all involved in. And the idea is that you don't have to join a union to get their representation in negotiations. And now what this new group is doing is saying, you can opt out, you can opt out, you can opt out. And of course you would be furious if you were a union. But it is to be expected because it's that group of people who do not want to see unionization. And it is right of the unions to point it out that they're doing it. On the other hand, as I say, it's absolutely expected.
The issue of coverage of Capital News, Alan, you've always talked about in your role as a professor, as a educator, public radio executive, the idea that light helps eliminate the dark in state politics and the corruption that can occur. And this week we witnessed the cutting in half of the Daily News editorial staff. One of the major people at the Capitol, Ken Lovett, who we talk to regularly for many programs on WAMC, survived that purge, but Glenn Blaine did not, who sits with him in the Capitol, and certainly less coverage of state news.
Well, there's no question. Look, the Daily News, interestingly, has been adamantly opposed to the Trump administration and to the decisions that are being made there. They've always been losing money. That's why Zuckerman, the last owner, sold it, for a dollar, and the Trump people had to assume, who bought it, had to assume the debts and the rest. It is not a profitable business right now, and at least it's not profitable in the case of the New York Post and the Daily News, who are losing a lot of money. So the new model seems to be that if you have a fish to fry one way or the other, you buy a newspaper. Certainly, we're all fans of what's happened with the Washington Post, but that's what happened. One of the richest men in the world, the same guy who owns Amazon, buys the Washington Post, infuses it with all kinds of good assets. And in the case of the Daily News, they just faced the inevitable. We were all knew that this meeting was going to take place. We at WAMC, the public radio station, were determined, and I suppose I should say this or shouldn't say it, but we were determined that if the best reporter in Albany, Ken Lovett, were dismissed, that we would hire him. One way or another, we would find the resources to hire him because we can't afford to lose a guy like that. We never talked to him about it, but amongst us at the radio station, that was where we were going. So we were delighted when he escaped the axe this time. But, you know, there are times that people who run public radio stations and who are heavily involved in the news have to know where their priorities are. And keeping a guy like Ken Lovett going is one of them.
I see that Guy Molinari, the Staten Island Republican, died.
A scion of modern Republicanism. He was Mr. Republican in New York. His daughter, Susan Molinari, congresswoman, and he was really the go-to guy when it came to Republican stuff. He had his issues over the years, but he lived to a ripe old age, and it's certainly worth noting his passing.
Legislative Gazette political observer, Alan Charton. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The long-horned tick has been found in Westchester County, New York. County and state officials confirmed their findings this month. Officials say the threat is mainly to livestock, but there's concern about whether it will transmit disease to humans. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn reports.
Dr. Sherlita Amler is Westchester County Health Commissioner.
It's noteworthy because it's the first time we've seen this tick in New York. The tick is normally a native to Australia, New Zealand, and Eastern Asia, but it's been recently found in New Jersey, Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, and Arkansas.
The New York State Health Department says it will continue to conduct surveillance and research on this new type of tick, and that it is encouraging that the same steps that protect against deer ticks are also effective against the longhorn tick. Again, Westchester County's Amler.
To date, there have been no reported cases of human disease associated with the longhorn tick in the United States. As a health department, we will remain vigilant and continue to monitor for human cases related to this particular tick.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer is an investigative journalist and author of Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change.
This is a very disturbing development in the realm of possible tick-borne disease. Here is a tick we never had before until it was discovered in New Jersey just last summer. And now it is spreading like wildfire. I mean, it has turned up in several states. It is now in New York. And while it is sudden and its spread is really unprecedented, the Asia tick is symptomatic of the ticks and the threat that we face from them today.
She mentions the spread in the U.S. of other tick species, including to the Northeast. Meantime, Amler says the tick was found in multiple locations in Westchester County.
Well, in Asia, it has been known to cause an infection that results in a high fever and low platelet counts. There's some theoretical data that it might be able to carry Lyme disease, but we've not had any cases, so I don't know that for certain. So I think what we have to do is wait and see.
She says the longhorn tick has transmitted disease to humans in other parts of the world, and more research is needed to determine whether this can happen in the United States. The State Department of Agriculture and Markets says the tick is a concern for the agricultural industry and encourages livestock owners and veterinarians to be vigilant for unusually heavy tick infestations. Spokesman Steve Ammerman says the New York Farm Bureau has passed along Ag and Markets info to farmers, urging them to check their animals for ticks and symptoms of tick-borne illnesses.
And this ties into a priority of New York Farm Bureaus, and that has been to bring more attention to tick-borne illnesses in general. Our farmers have seen more ticks on the farm, and we've also seen a greater incidence of tick-borne diseases like Lyme disease. A lot of it had started in like Long Island and Hudson Valley, but really we've seen it move to the western part of the state. And we've encouraged more funding, not only for research, but also to, you know, encourage and look for a vaccine, because this is a serious issue not only for our farmers, but for the public in general.
A vaccine, he says, for people. With a number of county fairs in New York taking place this summer and the prevalence of livestock at these fairs, Pfeiffer says the longhorn tick presents a genuine concern, even with no known cases of disease transmitted from this tick to people in the U.S.
But the fact that people are going to fairs, that there's a lot of livestock there, that the livestock may be trading ticks or passing ticks among themselves and perhaps to people, is a genuine concern. As far as this tick goes, we know very little about its possible threat.
A state ag and market spokeswoman says veterinarians and veterinary technicians from the department's Division of Animal Industry are present at every county fair and the state fair to provide a thorough check of the animals that arrive for competition. She says the biggest concerns the department sees regarding the longhorn tick are livestock that are checked infrequently by their owners, as may be the case in some pastured animals. She says fair animals typically arrive well-groomed.
A summer spike in violent crime has gripped New York's capital city, and a new police chief has been hired in Albany as concerns mount. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
On Sunday, Albany Common Councilwoman Dorcia Pleers joined others in a walk for peace in the city's South End to a makeshift memorial at the place where 32-year-old Elijah Cancer was shot dead earlier this month.
This is a community crying out not just for peace, but also for solutions and for individuals in our community to lay the guns down and not use guns as an option. There were people, of course, expressing their frustration, some who are scared, and then others who are very hopeful that with the right organizing, with bringing the right people to the table to connect with members of the community, that there is an opportunity to turn this around and stop the violence on our streets.
Soon, the city will install a new police chief. Late last week, Mayor Kathy Sheehan announced that Southfield, Michigan Police Chief Eric Hawkins has been appointed to the same position in Albany. Center for Law and Justice Executive Director Alice Green was on the panel that took part in the interview process.
He has incredible credentials. He has a lot of experience in law enforcement. He's very concerned about community policing. He's also very committed to police wellness, which I think is very important. And he's anxious to get to Albany, and I think he'll hit the ground running because he wants to meet the community and be involved with the community as much as possible.
Here's Mayor Sheehan on the process to replace retiring Acting Chief Robert Sears.
So there were a number of people who participated in that. They put forward four individuals for me to interview, and I held those interviews. And in speaking with Chief Hawkins, it was really clear to me very quickly that this was an individual who I thought had the right leadership skills, the right experience, and was really the right person for the city of Albany. So he is the only person that I extended an offer to, and I was very pleased that he accepted it.
It remains to be seen what effect, if any, the new chief will have on the recent violence. Meantime, the Guardian Angels have turned back up in the city. Group founder Curtis Sliwa says he'll be having a sit-down with Mayor Sheehan Thursday.
And it'll be interesting because clearly I'll pose the question to the mayor. If I'm an outsider, what is your brand new police commissioner, Eric Hawkins? I mean, he's further away from Albany than I am in New York City, and I've already spent time in the 80s in Arbor Hill in the South End. So it should be a very, very interesting atmosphere there because it's rife with hypocrisy.
City Hall today denied Sliwa's request. Pleers chairs the council's Public Safety Committee.
That is always a concern of some council members and residents. And then there are others who are optimistic that this candidate will bring fresh ideas and be able to apply some of his experience to what's happening here in Albany as it relates to gun violence with the hopes of having a successful outcome.
Albany County District Attorney David Soares.
This would be my seventh chief during my term. He will be welcomed here with open arms. He will be the department. I'm very convinced that the department will be supporting its new chief. This community will support its new chief. We just want this chief to stay with us.
The Albany Police Officers Union did not respond to a request for comment.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The tourism organization that markets and promotes the Adirondack region recently released its latest study of tourism trends in the region. The Leisure Travel Information Study finds outdoor activities remain the key attraction. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has more.
The Lake Placid-based Regional Office of Sustainable Tourism, or ROOST, markets Essex, Franklin, and Hamilton counties and towns and villages in the Adirondack Park. This is the 14th year that the Lake Placid-based office has commissioned an independent third party to assess travel trends in its market area. The study found that more than 960,000 visitors spent an average of $326 a day and generated about $240 million in 2017. Key attractions were outdoor activities, followed by relaxing, dining, shopping, and sightseeing. Hiking is the most popular outdoor interest, followed by canoeing and kayaking, fishing, boating, and skiing. ROOST CEO James McKenna says most of the results followed trends.
Clearly, the Adirondack environment is the main differentiator that we have on other places in the Northeast U.S. and even beyond that. So concentrating on the outdoor activities and the environment of the Adirondacks will always be our number one driver.
The trend has been for visitors to make shorter trips to the region and spend less. The report, for the first time, analyzes day trippers, campgrounds, and short-term renters and breaks down their spending by type of lodging. McKenna believes ROOST is one of the few organizations compiling such data.
We looked at the expenditure patterns of day trippers, short-term rentals, traditional lodging, which means hotel, motel, B&Bs, and resorts, and campgrounds, and those that visit family and friends. And although the short-term rental expenditure for total stay is the highest, it's the highest because of the lodging cost, believe it or not. When you look at meals and restaurants, they actually spend less than traditional lodging, and also shopping, they spend less. So overall, the short-term renters are paying more for lodging, but the other categories, they are not spending as much.
The Leisure Travel Study estimates visitors spend $62 for every marketing dollar spent. Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas says studies like this affirm that tourism marketing is an investment.
It's an investment in bringing more revenue and jobs and economic activity to your area. It's not an expense. The real return, of course, a direct return to a county, whether it's Clinton or Essex or Franklin or Albany or any place else, is on the sales tax side, because obviously much of those $62 that are then being spent in the area as a direct result of that marketing are being spent on things that generate county sales tax. Gasoline purchases, hotel rooms, attraction. It is the only investment, by and large, that local government really makes in generating tax revenue for itself. Sometimes that connection isn't made, that it's really an investment in generating sales tax revenues. And by the way, the more you do that, the less you have to put things on property taxes.
A link to the study is at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1830. Or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.